This is where we start. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Hussein Nasr. I'm very glad to be able to be here with you for several sessions of discussion of metaphysics. It's a very rare occasion. I've been teaching for over 55 years in universities. We began to teach at Harvard until now. It's a long, long time. I've never given a series of public lectures on metaphysics. It's always been private, always to a few students, but I know that this audience consists of really a choice of the most gifted and interested young Muslims around here. And when I was asked to give this talk, I accepted gladly. But to really understand what I'm going to say depends on a certain number of conditions which I want to lay out for you. This type of presentation of metaphysics in a serious way is not ordinary. It certainly was not ordinary in our civilization. Always, students were trained spiritually and intellectually for a long time before they were taught pure ma'rifah, which would correspond to metaphysics as I understand it, pure knowledge, pure divine knowledge. But one could say that one irregularity deserves another. We live in irregular times. I would have never accepted to discuss pure metaphysics to an audience which I do not know personally. I've had many students who I've trained personally over the years, some of our famous scholars and metaphysicians and philosophers, but like this. But I said one irregularity deserves another. We live in a world in which even in a religion like Islam, whose intellectual dimensions have been better preserved than many other religions, that access to the inner teachings of the religion become every day more and more difficult. Where outwardness, externality, simple external manifestation of teaching of the religion take the place of what is inward and interior. And knowledge in the sense that the Prophet والسلام, taught us is denigrated more and more. Of course, everybody studies technology and how to fix telephones and things like that, but principial knowledge, knowledge of the divine, gradually becomes eclipsed. In such a situation, when an opportunity like this arises, I think one has to change and the habits of what we've done before and to try to present metaphysics even when one doesn't know everyone in the audience. In a sense, metaphysics, as I'm going to be using it, the term, I should define the term in a moment, is like the fruit of a tree. You plant the fruit in the earth. A shoot comes out. You water it. Gradually the shoot grows. It grows into a small tree, and then it gives leaves, and gives next year flowers. And finally, after several years, it gives fruit which contains that very seed that you first planted. The story that I've told you, a very famous Sufi story. That first seed is theoretical metaphysics, theoretical knowledge. But the real knowledge is that second seed, which is realized knowledge. And in the Islamic tradition, authentic metaphysics was never taught as a mental exercise. It was taught as a way of realization of a knowledge which is sacred and which illuminates us and which integrates us and which allows us to know who we are. And who are we? We are either everything or nothing. That is, before God we are nothing. In our heart resides the divine throne, the throne of the compassionate. Qalbul Mu'min Ashur Rahman. So from that point of view, our heart is everything. And to realize this everythingness and nothingness is the goal of authentic metaphysics. And the path is the path of knowledge, of ma'rifah, of ilm in the Quranic sense, not to be confused with information. Knowledge is not information. It's a knowledge that moves the soul and transforms it. And that is why it's not meant for everybody. But without it, the civilization dies. What happened to Christianity in the West is that gradually metaphysics began to be lost. Once it was lost, theology could not defend the forts of the faith. From the Renaissance onward, we've had step by step, you might say, eroding of the presence of Christianity in Western society. For the first great religion, which lost its metaphysics. I'm not talking about philosophical metaphysics, I'm talking about Christian metaphysics. Christianity could no longer produce a Saint Bonaventure, could not produce a Dante. Nicholas of Cusa was one of the very last. So metaphysics is the prop of every religion. No religion exists in the world in which everybody is a metaphysician, whose followers, every one of his followers. That's not true. But there has to be there. Because there are always within a religious community those who ask why. Why is something what it is? And once the religion is no longer able to answer that, they would seek that elsewhere. Which is exactly what happened in the Christian West, and is happening to some extent among our youth in the Islamic world today. As they lose their relation and their hold upon the treasury of knowledge which could answer that call. If you're a 16-year-old, very gifted young man, and you ask, why is this so-and-so, and your imam in the mosque cannot answer it. 500 years ago, there would have been someone like Ghazali who would have answered it, a sheikh, Sufi sheikh, traditional philosophers. Where are they? They're not around. Either you have, they would say, shut up, or go read the Quran, you'll find out. And he goes and reads, and by himself he cannot find out. Gradually doubt comes into his mind, and one of two things occurs. Either he becomes a modernist, diluted person, religiously speaking, or the other way around, he stops asking the questions which his soul had asked and becomes a pure externalist and sees only the external act of religion. And oftentimes that leads to anger, that leads to aggression, and certainly we've seen enough of that in our world. Many of these people today who are aggressively doing what they're doing, killing people off, women and children in the name of Islam sometimes, they're people who at a moment in their life needed to have certain questions answered which were not answered for them. So metaphysics is not just a luxury. It's a sine qua non, a necessity of any living religion. And any religion in which the sapiental aspect, the aspect of knowledge, disappears completely, gradually becomes a shell of its former self, and it either decays or dies. And we've had plenty of cases of that in history. Now that should be enough to show us that the subject that was chosen for me for these lectures, I don't know who chose them, but the people around the conference, is not a trivial matter. I would certainly at this age would not have wasted my time coming all the way from Washington to talk about trivia, or to say something that would make you feel good for a few moments. I hope you do something more important than that. What I'm going to try to do during these three sessions with you is, first of all, to try to make you understand what real metaphysics is. What the pretensions to metaphysics have been, and what it entails, and how can you get hold of it, how can you study it, how can you be it, which is even more important, and finally, how it's related to the other Islamic intellectual disciplines. That's really my program for the next three lectures. Unfortunately, it was printed by mistake the way the program I saw sent to me, but this is what I shall be discussing with you today, after an hour's rest again today, and then tomorrow the last session. So let me first of all start with the word. Many people think that the word metaphysics in European languages is a very unfortunate term. because it put the knowledge which is central somewhere out there. The word meta, the Greek prefix, means two things, both after and beyond. And actually, metaphysics began very innocently as a Greek term of the name of a book written by Aristotle in the 4th century BC called Metaphysica. That is the book to read after physics. After physics, that's what it meant. After physics. But it's in this particular book, which is the book Lambda of the Metaphysica of Aristotle, where major metaphysical questions are discussed, namely, what is being? Like, what is it that's the foundation of all things? Every other question comes back to this. But every question you ask presumes being. So what is being? Is the famous book Lambda of Aristotle. And in that book, Aristotle then turns on to other important issues, which are metaphysical issues, including how is knowledge possible? What is the root of knowledge? And all kinds of things like that to which I shall turn. This made the term metaphysics famous in Greek. And since the book called Metaphysica in Greek dealt with these issues, the subject itself came to be known as metaphysics. And it came from Greek, first of all, into Arabic. For a whole century, from the 2nd to the 3rd Islamic century, Islamic translators and philosophers, even Al-Kindi, the first great Islamic philosopher, who wrote the treatise on metaphysics, were asking, how do you translate it into Arabic? It is ma ba'd al-tabi'a, ma fawq al-tabi'a, or something else. Even the word itself. And finally, they settled down after one century of debate for what is called ma ba'd al-tabi'a. Tabi'a means physica, physics in the Greek sense, not in the modern sense. And of course, ma, what, ba'd comes after. They went back to the original meaning of metaphysical in Greek. That is not is above, but after. What you read as a student after reading the physical. Became known as ma ba'd al-tabi'a. And it entered into Arabic in that sense and was used by the Islamic peripatetic philosophers who were trying to Islamicize, and in fact succeeded in doing so, the philosopher Aristotle and Neoplatonism, people like Farabi and Avicenna, and the term became common. But it had a very different meaning in Islam than it had in the West. And that defines to a large extent the career of these two civilizations. I shall come back to that in a moment. So let's get back to metaphysics and metaphysical. The West, of course, inherited the Greek heritage, some of it directly, mostly of it through Arabic, through Islam. And it took 1,000 years for the West to inherit Aristotle. The metaphysics of Aristotle did not go from Greek into Latin. It was translated into Arabic. After several centuries, it was translated from Arabic into Latin, and Hebrew both, but into Latin, with commentaries of Avicenna and others. And so everything the West saw in the metaphysics was through Muslim eyes, and that's very, very significant, very significant. But the term metaphysics became very important in the European Middle Ages. Before that, the Europeans had used certain terms which are not known to all of you, but which I want to revive for our discussion. If you ever want to discuss metaphysics seriously, not just play of words of modern philosophy, but seriously, as we understand it, by who's we? And people like myself were traditional Muslim thinkers rooted in the Islamic tradition. I reject fully, completely all Western understandings about the Islamic tradition of the world. You know my writing, some of you. I stand for the Islamic and other traditions of the world. I'm a traditionalist. What we understand is very, very important to pay attention to this point, that there were other terms before Aristotle became famous, thanks to Avicenna and Averroes, in the West that was sometimes used, that I want you to know these terms. One was the term that was used by the early Christian fathers, which is another Greek term, which in English is called theosophy. Theosophy. Theosophia. Which means the wisdom of God. And which has its exact equivalent in Arabic, al-hikmatul ilahiyah, which means exactly that, divine wisdom, al-hikmatu al-ilahiyya. And another word which very soon became an anathema in the Western Church, not the Orthodox Church, in the Western Church, because it was opposed by the Vatican, by the Catholic Church, as being dangerous to Christianity, that's the word gnosis, or gnosis. G-N-O-S-I-S. If I can teach you anything these 3 days, this one word gnosis, whatever it means, I will have done a lot. Let me talk about the roots of this word. I think after these 3 lectures I give you, all of you should know the term gnosis. I usually reserve it for the translation of the Arabic word ma'rifa in Arabic and irfan in Persian and Urdu and Turkish and other Islamic languages. The two are the same. Ma'rifa or irfan. But irfan in Arabic does not mean ma'rifa. A famous journal published in Kuwait about bicycles is called irfan. You know, the articles about bicycles and swimming and things like that. So don't mistake that. We don't use the word irfan in Arabic a lot. It's ma'rifa in Arabic. But in the other Islamic languages, especially Persian, which is the mother of the other languages, metaphysically, irfan. So the two terms are synonymous if you take all the Islamic languages together. This is how I always translate the word gnosis. But the word, just for your own understanding, to see how profound language is, gnosis, which means illuminative knowledge, the knowledge that unifies, the knowledge that makes one, it has the word GN in it. Gnosis, G-N, I just spelled it for you, O-S-I-S. I once said that the great tragedy of the modern world is the English language has a word for the lack of gnosis called ignorance. It has no word for gnorance. Nobody knows. But non-knowing has a word that we use all the time. Very, very telling. Our intellectual and spiritual situation. Why do we have a word in English for ignorance? Why has it a negative prefix, I, and then ignorance, which we call ignorance, to ignore. You don't have to ignore. But logically we should, because ignore is a negation of gnosis, of knowing. So deep down, the root GN in Indo-European languages means to know. And the word know itself is K-N. A K which is not pronounced. K-N. And even in French, it's very interesting. All that has to do with this, the word connaître. Connaître. Which in a sense means to be born again. Which is another very profound etymology. Connaître, this is Canada, you can speak a few words of French. Connaître also is related to the word C-N. Or K-N. So this root, wherever you see it, has to do with knowledge. And the most common word is knowledge itself. But gnosis came to have a meaning of a very special kind of knowledge. Principial knowledge. I use the word principial, not principal. It's a word which I, and a few writers in the English language half a century ago, decided to use. Because there was no word in the European languages for the word asala in Arabic. I wanted to translate asalatul wujud into English. And I couldn't find a word that was satisfactory, so I used the word principial. Editors would always cross it out and say, no, this is wrong. Finally, they accept that. It means that which is related to principles. Us in Arabic, principle. So principial, not principal. Principial. And gnosis means principial knowledge. Knowledge that pertains to the roots of things, to the ultimate reality. And that is none other than metaphysics. So we have, if you look at the whole history of Western languages dealing with the subject, Western philosophy and Western thought, we have the word metaphysics, we have the word theosophy, we have the word gnosis. And of course we have the word philosophy itself, and I'll come to this situation now. From the point of view of universal metaphysics, the greatest tragedy that occurred to the West before even the Middle Ages was that metaphysics became a branch of philosophy. Whereas it was never the case in other traditions. For example, in the Islamic tradition, Irfan Ma'rifa is not a branch of philosophy. In the Arabic writings, they're not a branch of Islamic philosophy. They're philosophical. That's something else. They're related to philosophy, but it's not a branch of it. That is the independence of that type of knowledge which goes directly to the source of reality and which comes from reality. We shall get to that, how can we know? Metaphysics in a short time. That comes from the supreme reality and with the means of knowing that also comes from the supreme reality. Both the knower and the known, the subject and the object, come from the divine ultimate reality. Now, philosophy, as used in the West, has many, many different meanings. But one of the great tragedies that occurred is metaphysics came to be considered a branch of philosophy. It's still taught like that at the University of Toronto. Or Harvard University. Any of the universities, I've been trying to pick out the University of Toronto, which used to have a very good department of philosophy in the old days, better than most universities. I don't know what it's doing now. But philosophy is dead in the modern West anyway. I don't consider modern Western philosophy. I've always called it misosophy, the hatred of wisdom, which people don't like very much, but that's what it is. Take misosophy 1, misosophy 2, then misosophy 101, and go on. Anyway, come back to more serious matters. So let's first remember this terminology, that authentic metaphysics is not a branch of rational philosophy. The term happens to have been used historically by Aristotle, describing different parts of his philosophy. Logic, natural philosophy, or physics, and then metaphysics. But it's not a part of philosophy. Unless you talk about sacred philosophy, philosophia perennis, perennial philosophy, of which I'm one of the supporters, at the heart of which is pure metaphysics and gnosis. But in the ordinary sense of use of philosophy, as you, especially young Muslim audience, you must never make this mistake. The Islamic tradition never made this mistake. It's one of its distinguishing marks from Christianity, the Christian tradition. Never made this mistake of making metaphysics subservient to philosophy. And even people like Ibn Sina, who were trying to follow the model of Aristotle, they tried to make some adjustments. And he also wrote writings which are really independent of this subservience of metaphysics to rational philosophy. You must understand. Now, I want to continue in this way of giving some definitions. One or two more words drawn from Latin and Arabic to define what metaphysics is, at least in name. One of the words which I've been using for decades, and which has a medieval background, is scientia sacra, sacred science, scientia sacra. Saint Bonaventure uses that term. And so do many other people, so does Saint Thomas. I use the word sacred science and scientia sacra in two different ways, as a matter of fact, one in Latin, one in English. I will not go into that now, because I consider traditional sciences, which are applications of metaphysics, to be what I would call sacred science in English. Scienza sacra as the metaphysics itself, that which can is the principle of all the traditional sciences. So let's get acquainted with this term, scienza sacra. When I gave my Gifford lectures in 1981 in Edinburgh, one chapter is called Scienza Sacra, Sacred Science, in which I deal with the summary of what a metaphysics is. I don't want to assign it in my own books, but this is like a course, a little bit of a course here. Those of you who want to read more about what your humble self says about this, go to Knowledge of the Sacred, Chapter 4, dealing with what is metaphysics. And it's called Scienza Sacra, Sacred Science. So this is one term, which is historically also has been identified with the supreme knowledge. I'm one of those people who hates to invent words, even in Persian. The only word I've ever invented is the word sunnat for tradition. I was the first person to use in the Persian language. That's one of the most common words in the Persian language. You have coffee shops which are called sunnati, miniatures, and headdresses of women and everything else. That's only my contribution to the Persian language, in coining new words. So I don't want to coin new words. I did not coin Scienza Sacra. I helped to resuscitate it with the help of one or two European writers who decided once, several decades ago, to try to resuscitate this term. I'm always in favor of resuscitating traditional terms. Every language tradition is so rich, if you delve into it, you will find everything there. And this, in this case, Aristotle was so right, there's nothing new under the sun, in a certain sense. So I'm against those people who make up words all the time and so forth, and at the very antipode. But in this case, it's an important term, I think, for you who are, you're not my students, but you're friends exchanging knowledge together, for you to share with me. Now, it's very interesting to point out to non-Western terminology. I already spoke of Mawada Tabi'a and Irfan, but in the Persian and Arabic languages, the two main languages of Islamic intellectual discourse, there are certain other terms which metaphysics is equated with as we use it in English. And it's not Mawada Tabi'a. One of them is that the Alim al-Ali, the supreme science, the supreme science, Al-Ilm al-Ali, and Al-Ulum al-A'la, sometimes in the plural, the supreme science. That's one of the terms that is very, very important to understand. Then we come to the Quranic term, which has, like all Quranic terms, levels of meaning. Those who try to limit the Quran only to its external meaning, which is becoming so common in our day and age, are really doing a great travesty to God's word. I've done my little share. The study of Quran is alhamdulillah finished. I finished it last week before coming, and 2015 it will come out. And it's the opposite of all of these other commentaries that come out, that give you all the levels of meaning of the various verses of the Quran, inshallah. You will all see it very soon. One of the terms in the Quran, which is used twice in the Quran, comes from the root hakama, which can mean both knowledge and judgment, like the word huk. But it's the meaning I want you to point to is the word hikmah. Hikmah. H-I-K-M-A-H in Arabic and M-A-T in Persian and N-E-T in Turkish. It's common in every Islamic language. One of the most famous Quranic terms. Not to be confused again with the word huk and mahkum and mahkama and all of these legal terms which have to do with giving judgment, legal judgment. They're both the same root, but different meaning. The word wisdom here, hikmah. What does it mean? The Quran says, verily to the person to whom we have given hikmah, we have given much, a great blessing, a great khayr. Now, what does this hikmah mean? Islamic history is replete with examples of different interpretations of this. Even the great Imam Fakhr al-Razi, the famous theologian of the 12th century, himself gives an account of different meanings given to the term hikmah. And I'm not going to go over it with you now. All the way from the Quran itself being called hikmah, which it is, it's one of the names of the Quran, to Islamic law, to Islamic theology, to having ethical norms and knowing how to act correctly, all of these, but also to supreme knowledge. And this term was kept in Islamic civilization in great appreciation and had always an aura around it. To be hakim was a very high level of realization and had two meanings in Islamic civilization, either to be a physician or to be a philosopher, if I'm going to speak in English. The word hakim. And that's why medicine was related to philosophy very closely, and the greatest Islamic physician was also the most famous Islamic philosopher, Avicenna. And even Averroes was also a doctor. And the early Muslim philosophers were all doctors. They knew medicine. The later ones, no. They made their living from Islamic law. It's very interesting. And the 12th century, because it was considered that hikmah is so precious, traditional philosophy, metaphysics, is so precious, we should never teach it for money. We should always teach it freely. And all the great teachers I studied with in Persia, I was so fortunate that I was able to study with the greatest of the last generation, that we have supreme master of the science, and there's no one like them in Iran right now. They never charged any money. It was always free. No matter what you did, you tried to buy them a book as a gift, they would not accept. It was a sunnah. So they had to make a living. And the early Islamic centuries, they make their living through medicine. And so the word hakim came to have these two meanings. And it persists in Arabic, Urdu, Persian, up to our own day. We say for in Persian, hakim bashim is a doctor, old doctor, traditional doctor. The second meaning meant philosopher. And that is the meaning that is very, very important, comes from this Quranic term. The Islamic thinkers considered this hikmah from the Quran to be supreme Sophia, supreme philosophy. So therefore, metaphysics. That was one of the names of metaphysics. And then the Sufis, especially in Arabic, has writes about this in the Futuhat, about the word hikmah. And that the word hikmah refers to the highest wisdom. Highest wisdom, which means the nature of God. And our relation to that nature, how we get there. So these are cognate terms in one way or another, none of them identical to each other, but presents a very rich field of meaning when it comes to the discussion of metaphysics. If I were giving this lecture in Persian or in Arabic right now, I would be using one of these terms. Since I'm giving it in English, I just thought I would explain it to you, because almost all of you are Muslims, to have an understanding of the very rich, diverse intellectual field with which your ancestors were concerned, how much they were concerned with these issues. This was not a fluke interest of two or three people sitting in some school in Isfahan. It was throughout the Islamic world, and we had to have hakims, so many in West Surah, Pakistan, in India, in Hyderabad, in the Malay world, not to speak about, of course, Turkey, the Persian world, and the Arab world, the central region of the Islamic world, and African world, the many hakims, people, wise people. And you expect a hakim to know in a principial way, to know what really is worth knowing, to know with a capital N. That's implicated in the word hakim, which is such a person is a hakim, a wise person. And one of the very interesting things is the disappearance of this term in English. The closest translation to a hakim, would be sage. Nobody's called sage anymore. Unless, you know, they predict a football match on Monday morning or something like that. That's the level of being a sage. But in a real sense, nobody's called a sage. I remember when 50 years ago I gave those lectures at Harvard that became the three Muslim sages. On purpose, resuscitated this term in English language, using the word sages. And I've met with a lot of opposition. What is this term used? Can't you change it through philosophy? I said, no. I went to resuscitate the term sage. But sage is more than the philosopher at present in the Anglo-Saxon world, especially with the limitation of philosophy since the 19th century in the Anglo-Saxon world, with logical positivism and analysis and so forth. And as I said, it's a more a kind of misosophy than philosophy, because no interest in wisdom. Whereas sage is always to be concerned with wisdom. And in Western society, there are always people who call sages. They disappeared from the scene. We don't have any wise old men. We have a lot of old men. We don't have any wise old men. It's very rare, especially when it comes to knowledge. Someone whose feet one could sit, as one still does in some part of the Islamic world or India, and learn wisdom. That's one of the great tragedies, that we have so many baby faces until they're 80 years old. People don't age spiritually as they do. They only age biologically. That culture doesn't provide that. But the word itself, sage, is a very beautiful and important word. And also in French, sage and sagesse, which we have the word sagacity in English, which is related to the word sagesse, which also depicts metaphysics. I didn't get into that. All right, so much for this. Now I want to turn another set of realities which have to do with where do we find metaphysics? If you look in various civilizations, where is it? In almost every traditional civilization, this kind of knowledge was hidden from the eye of the populace. It was kept for the few. As I said at the very beginning, metaphysics is not for the many, it's for the few. And we say, oh, this is so elitist. Of course it's elitist. Why not? If this were a conference on mathematics, if I were a mathematician, after I studied mathematics at MIT for years, I understand mathematics, and if I were going to put some Fourier series on the board, only a few, 30 people in Toronto would understand it. So I would be elitist. But in mathematics or physics, nobody blames anyone for being elitist. As soon as we come to metaphysics, everybody is supposed to know. If everybody doesn't know, we're being elitists. And this is absurd. Totally absurd. In Arabic, we have the wonderful word of khawas and awam. Awam means the populace. Khawas means those who are elites. And this is not a democracy or pejorative appellation of the majority. In medicine, I'm among the awam. Those two gentlemen sitting there are doctors, they're khawas. But we've lost this term, so it seems like they have a cursing saying elitist. Elite in the real sense. Now, everybody's made for something. Someone may be an excellent sitar player, but doesn't know how to integrate calculus. Somebody may be a good quantum mechanic, doesn't know any philosophy. In modern Western civilization, those things like architecture or physics or mathematics are unique to the specialists. But when it comes to discussion of theology and metaphysics, everybody's supposed to know everything. And you say, this is not for you, this is an affront. But if I tell some freshman student that the theory of relativity of Einstein is not for you, wait until you study physics for a few more years, he will not be hurt. So, yes, it is elitist in the sense that not everyone has been created by God to be a metaphysician. But those who have this calling, they better listen to it. And where do they find it? The person who seeks after this kind of knowledge, who is not happy only with career promotions and everyday external things. He wants to know why things are what they are. Where do we come from? Where are we going? What happens to us after death? These ultimate fundamental existential questions. Not everybody can relegate that to the back of her mind. Some people have to live with it and they have to find answers. Now, where does one find it? In all traditions, Islamic, Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, Jewish, wherever you go, in the traditions, this was not on the marketplace for everyone. You had to seek it. Why did Christ say, seek and you shall find? He, whom modern Christian considered to be the prophet of democracy, who loved everyone equally. What did one have to seek? It should be there for everyone. The fact that you have to seek it, that means it's not for everyone. Seekers, finders in the game that children play, not everybody finds. So the very fact that Christ says, seek and you shall find, means that there's something there that you have to seek before you find it. And there's even more direct, many are called but few are chosen. How undemocratic of Christ. I love Christ, I'm not criticizing him, I'm criticizing the stupid modern world that looks upon this such profound sayings and just doesn't want to defend. It's been Christmas, doesn't want to attack Christianity, just forgets about this. It was Christ who said, many are called, but few are chosen. So is God unfair? No, there's some people have certain callings. And Christianity is full of that. But this has been forgotten so much. Now, in the tradition which are still very much alive and have kept their inner dimension, the metaphysics can only be found in the inner dimension. And let me just give you some terms that related to that. First of all, the word esotericism, which again, many people criticize, and many people don't understand that this is esoteric. It's not rules of football that are esoteric. I don't mean esoteric in that sense. Eso in Greek means in. Esoteric means inward. That which is inward. You are all looking at me, you should look at my outward aspect. When I speak, something of my inwardness comes out, but you don't know of my inwardness. Obviously, I don't know your inwardness. We have an inner world within us. And God himself describes himself as having an inward dimension. Because God says in the Quran, وَالْأَوَّلُ وَالْأَخْرُ وَالظَّاهِرُ وَالْبَاطِنُ. God is also the inward. So this is not a bad word to use, inwardness. Because of divine quality. Every outwardness has an inwardness. Everything outward has an inner aspect. I always say to my students, the word phenomenon, which you use all the time, Greek word. Phenomenon means appearance of. Of what? That what is the inward. The very word phenomenon implies inwardness. But then anybody bothering to talk about it, that's the most blatant understanding, clear understanding of the very term, the Greek term. And you say appearance in English. Appearance always implies of something. It always implies a subject. And so in Islam we have the word, of course, esotericism is a Greek word, but we have the word ilm al-batin. Not to be confused with the Bataniyah, where Ismailis in the 11th, 12th century, sometimes Ismailis were called the Bataniyah. I don't mean that Bataniyah. That's a very complex historical issue of the history of Islamic thought. I'm not going to go into that. But ilm al-batin or ahl al-batin is used to this very day for certain people in my own country, Iran, in the 19th century, one of the greatest Sufis, Imam Reza Qumshayi, one of his titles was Ahl al-Batin, person of the inner path, of inner reality, one of the greatest saints and philosophers, both philosophers and saints, an incredible man, who they said performed miracles, karamat and so forth, but also was a great philosopher, a commentator on Mullah Sadr and his teaching. And he was called Ahl al-Batin. So we have the word Batin, which I want us all to know. And I want to turn to the word ilm itself, which has now been to a large extent secularized in modern Arabic and other Islamic languages, because if you're studying physics, you say your ilm fizik, your ilm fizika in Arabic. But traditionally, don't forget that ilm is the name of God. Wal alim. The name Arif is not a divine name. It's very interesting that principial knowledge is not a name of God, but the word ilm al-alim is the name of God. So as again Ibn Arabi says, in a sense, ilm in its highest level stands even above ma'rifah. And the real ilm is the supreme metaphysics, the supreme knowledge. Because the knowledge that God has of himself by nature of being an alim, the knowledge that God has of himself with any veil. And it's that knowledge which is the source of all knowledge, ultimately. And so when we think of the term metaphysics in the Islamic context, the very word ilm that we use all the time, and every Pakistani father and mother in the city want their child to go after this ilm, provided it's medicine or engineering, otherwise the mother will suffocate a heart attack. You know, I don't want to joke about this. Because every year I come here, I receive telephone calls of this related to the subject. Ilm is not only that. Ilm, of course, is ultimately means knowledge by God and knowledge of God. And even more deeply, every knowledge that we have is ultimately related to that. That was the whole subject of my knowledge in the sacred. But knowledge itself, by definition, implies the light of God's knowledge. If God were not al-alim, I would not know. It's now 4:15. All human knowledge is a reflection of God's knowledge of himself. And by virtue of what he has placed in us, taqbiya fina, as in Arabic they say, has placed in us, has built in us, knowledge of us, by us of God. And knowledge by us of God cannot come about unless God has knowledge of us. In the same way that no one can love God without God loving him or her. No one can know God without God allowing him to know him and therefore knowing him. Of course, God knows us in principle. It doesn't have to know. But God can also forget us. The Quran says, those who forget God, God forgets them. This is, of course, not in the principal sense that divine knowledge being limited. Divine knowledge is infinite. But to have God's direct knowledge, attention to us, that it's only that makes it possible for us to know God. Don't forget, once I gave a lecture here 2 years ago, I said this. The person who forgets God, God has already forgotten him. Never forget that. Yes, we forget God. That's because God has forgotten us. Every act metaphysically goes from the source to the, from the cause to the effect, not from the effect to the cause. Everything originates from the divine principle. Except we don't see the other half. So we only see our half and see our reactions to it. Now, let me turn, because time is passing by. Already I've spoken for 15 minutes, and I shall give you, it's such a large audience, I don't know whether I have time to or should have questions and answers. Who's in charge of the session? Should we have questions and answers? Mr. Fuzan, come here. Fuzan Khan, all the Pakistanis are Khan by definition. Should we have questions and answers?
If you would like, yes, we have.
What have the other people done?
Some of them have taken questions.
All right, we'll see. It's going to be very difficult to ask questions and answer such a large audience. I should say, not that I'm afraid of answering your answers, answering your questions. I hope I die and this record will not be broken. I've given thousands of lectures over the countries of the world. Never been a question somebody asked, I've not been able to answer. I think I can answer that. I just the question of being able to manage such a large audience. We shall see. Anyway, let me perhaps spend some time. The next question I want to ask ourselves is, now that we're into something of the term metaphysics, the cognate terms, dealing with the principial knowledge, and knowledge which illuminates and transforms and unites us with that which is the principle of being, with God himself, in the theological language of the Abrahamic families. The question can come up, should come up, what does the supreme science deal with? What does metaphysics deal with? Now, here again, we come into a very, very complex set of problems that I really do not have a right to get into in detail because I cannot presume that all of you have studied years of philosophy. But the Western tradition, going back to Aristotle, where he says in the book Lambda of Metaphysics that the subject of metaphysics is being qua being. Being qua being, or on in Greek. This continued that this highest science, the science of being, with a capital B, and God is pure being, and there was a science of God as pure being. However, authentic metaphysics, the highest level, even goes beyond that. That is, their ultimate goal of metaphysics is to know the real, with a capital R. And the real in universal metaphysics is even beyond being. It is itself the beyond being. Inconceivable. ای برتر از خیال و قیاس و گمان و وهم و از هر چه گفتن در شنیدیم و خواندیم سعدی است. I'm just summarizing this. O thou who art beyond every analogy, every comparison, every limit that can be set to it, everything I've ever read, everything I've ever heard, and so forth. I won't translate the whole verse. I just want you to hear this one verse of poetry. Once you invite me, you're stuck. I just have to quote one poem. I'm a Persian, and I'm from the age of five. I memorized half of Persian poetry, and much of it is still in me. It's amazing, this language. Every metaphysical principle I've learned all my life, there are poems that pertain to it. Just have to know how to use that poem. Anyway, divine principle is beyond everything, including pure being, which is the most universal concept that our mind can hold. Not only is it beyond being, but it's not even limited by being beyond being. This is very difficult to understand, obviously. This in Arabic is called Al-Dhat Bila Es Wa Bila Ras in classical Islamic metaphysics. The divine essence, which has no name and has no definition. And then it gets much more complicated. That is the concept that a wujud, provided you set no conditions on it, la bishart, or first setting the condition of negativity upon it, that is, everything is negative from it, bishart la, and then no setting no condition, la bishart, and finally you have the highest reality, which is called la bishart maqsami, that reality which is so above that it itself is the ground for the divisions you've made so far. So you already reach pure transcendence. The human language stops. I have studied Islamic philosophy for 50 years, and I think I know a little bit about this subject. First of all, it's extremely difficult to teach it in a class like this. It's not impossible. when I was studying traditional philosophy in Iran, which is traditional metaphysics, we spent 6 months with one of the greatest masters just going over to these two, three terms until they became instilled in the mind, as we do also for fiqh and kalam and many other things. Especially in this subject, it's very abstruse and very difficult. But let me just say that it is its subject, its highest subject, is the real as such, which is beyond every conception, every determination, every limit, and beyond the conception of being beyond every limit and every determination. But that itself is a condition. I'll say no more about this. Think a little bit about this. But just take my word for it. If you want to, otherwise, you have to understand. You can't understand that it takes a lot of meditation, a lot of thing, and it takes God's help. And it's a kind of illumination. But anyway, begin with that which is boundless. The one of the most beautiful expressions of this is found at the beginning of one of the most important sacred scriptures of the world. The Tao that can be named is not the Tao. It's the beginning of the Tao Te Ching, which corresponds exactly to La Ilaha Illallah. I have some of my former students here trying to get me to publish the translation I made of Tao Te Ching 35 years ago into Persian, from the original that was found in Beijing, when the old Chinese text was found, with some commentary, Islamic commentary, and perhaps one day I shall do it when the Quran project is finished. But how remarkable, the Tao that can be named is not the Tao. The name that can be named is not the name. And that's exactly the poem of Sa'di. It's Bartar as Khiyal o Qiyas o Gaman wa. That is, everything you say about it is beyond it. As soon as you name it, you limit it. And pure metaphysics begins with that. With absolute reality, which is even beyond the concept of absoluteness. Because the absolute reality, which also includes the non-absolute, the relative. And this is beyond our mental capacity. No matter how intelligent we are, it's really transcendent. And its source has to come from the transcendent itself for us to say, ah, I see. But once one sees, with the help of the divine, I believe, it's just not like mathematics that the teacher is a good math student, and the student has the capabilities, some people are made for this kind of abstract thought, some people are not, then we have its auto-determination. It determines itself, because there's nothing else outside of it. It determines itself, and its first auto-determination is being with a capital B. Esse, in Latin. Now, this is where all Western metaphysics really begins. St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Bonaventure, the greatest metaphysicians of the Middle Ages, they all begin with pure esse. Pure being is God. And many Islamic philosophers do also. One of my greatest favorites, about whom I've written so much, Saruddin Shirazi, Mullah Sadra, says God is pure being, but is not bound by being pure being. So it opens the door to that beyond being, which you have alluded to directly in the Tao Te Ching. And you also have alluded to in the Upanishads. When Yajnavalka asked the master, what is Brahman? And he keeps saying, no, no, neti, neti. And whatever he says, no, no. That is beyond everything you can conceive, everything you can say. God is beyond everything you can conceive. But he's also the source of everything you can conceive. He's the source of everything that there is. And so the auto-determination is being, with a capital B. Now, it's this cardinal concept that has been denied by modern European philosophy. Leibniz was the last person to speak about it seriously, and the student of Descartes Malebranche. Since the 17th century, Western philosophy has not been concerned with being. There have been people here and there, and I know there are some young Muslim students taking philosophy in college. Do not be fooled by what Martin Heidegger says about Sein und Dasein. Martin Heidegger, the very famous and important German philosopher, I do not want to belittle him, he's a very important philosopher, but he's fooled many people. They think that he's revived the study of being in the West, whereas what he means by being means human being, human life. That is not being what Molosadra understood it, or Sadzavari or Abhisena understood it. Don't make a mistake about that. Korban, Henri Korban, my dear friend, with whom we taught for 20 years at Tehran, 17 years at Tehran University, and I lectured off at the University of Sorbonne when he was there. And he had gone to study with Heidegger. He went from Fribourg down the Black Forest, from Black Forest down to Fribourg in Germany to meet Heidegger. And he's translated Wasserstadt Metaphysik into French, the first work of Heidegger that translated to French, and which made Jean-Paul Sartre and the French existentialism possible. Korban once said something wonderful. He was sitting right next to me, he was speaking French, and was translating to Persian and commenting upon it. He said, for Heidegger, being is for death. For Mullah Sadra, being is for eternal life. That is, it's a being that opens up unto the eternal. So don't think that all this discussion of Sein, which in German means being, and Dasein, and so forth, is the same thing as our wujud. Book after book comes out, many by Muslims, and in Iran and Turkey, that's a favorite subject. Another one just came out last week. I saw it, comparing Heidegger to Persian understanding Islamic philosophy of wujud. That's not at all it. That's not at all it. The person who really opened the door to the understanding of wujud in their traditional sense is Friedrich Schuon. It's his discussion of being that opens the door to the metaphysics of being. Otherwise, academic philosophy, either they deny this category completely, like the analytical philosophers at the University of Toronto or London or Oxford, because Canada's philosophy is almost completely based on English philosophy, except in Quebec. In Quebec, Laval and M. Morel also follow French schools of philosophy. The English school of philosophy denies, in fact, the significance of being. Quine, people like that, it's not a category of philosophy. Or the French school, which talks about existentialism and angst, de l'être, and things like that. But that is not really being in a metaphysical sense. So authentic metaphysics deals, first of all, with beyond being, and then it deals with being. Secondly, or thirdly, it deals with existence, with the capital E. Now, I would spend years and years trying to purify the use of these terms. I don't fling them around because there's so much confusion. Classical philosophy was like today's chemistry. Every term was clearly defined. Whereas modern European philosophy is based on ambiguities a lot. That's why analytical philosophy is trying to clarify terms, except the important terms they throw out. Now, the word existence, of course, means like the existence of a car or I exist of a home or something like that. But it's with a small e, or something exists and is possesses some form of being. I'm putting aside now existentialism, don't talk about it. We use the word existence with a capital E, meaning the act of being with the capital B, which existentiates the cosmos. Again, you're a Muslim. قَالَ اللَّهُ كُنْ فَيَكُونَ in chapter 33. God said, be and there was. Kun, amr form, command form of the verb kaf, waw, nun, kaun, which can also mean the cosmos, the world. And it's related to Aramaic and Syriac word, krono, in Arabic. You all know it. فَيَكُونَ God said, be, and there was. Now that Amr, the command of God, Kun, is not God himself. Because God said, the subject of the Quranic verb is God himself. So obviously Kun is not God. That would be existence with a capital D. If I give this scriptural example, it makes it much easier to understand. And then, of course, the world in function of the divine principle. I'm going to deal with that tomorrow, inshallah. If any energy is left in me, I'll try my best. Also, another function of metaphysics is to understand the fundamental attributes, characteristics of the real. The real is beyond all attributes and is the source of all positive attributes. See how beautiful La ilaha illallah is. That's a perfect metaphysical expression. A pure metaphysics on the highest level. No reality except the absolute reality. No reality except the absolute reality. But then from that flows Muhammadun Rasulullah. That every positive manifestation comes from God. That's here the Prophet is not only a man, but represents God's creation, the perfection of his creation, and therefore containing himself all the positive qualities. And yet therefore all positive qualities are Rasul, are sent by Allah. And so Islam in these two fundamental shahadat, La ilaha illallah Muhammadun Rasulullah, contains the pure metaphysics that the source is beyond all things, yet all that is positive flows from the source. That's what the two shahadas are ultimately. All the religious meanings are there. I didn't negate those, please. I mean, Sayyid is my ancestor. I would never try to belittle this person. It's not for Allah, the greatest person I've ever lived from my point of view. But it's more than that. He represents God's creation. The Ahsan, the best of God's creation. He's an Unmudash, that is a kind of sample of all the qualities manifested in the cosmos, all the positive qualities. So these two shahadatain correspond to these two aspects of the role of metaphysics. First of all, to understand the real to the extent that we can by removing its confines, by opening our consciousness towards the infinite, and secondly, by showing that all that is positive comes from that which we cannot comprehend. Because to comprehend means to enfold. Comprehendere, Latin, means to put your arms around something. And God is infinite. We cannot put our arms around Him. So we cannot comprehend in the ordinary sense. We can only immerse ourselves in His infinite reality. And so all authentic metaphysics deals also with God as the absolute, God as the infinite, and God as pure goodness. The three fundamental qualities of God, from which in a sense flow all our own divine names, all the 99 names of beautiful Asma'ul Husna, which are the greatest heritages of Islam to humanity. You should pay attention to those. Incredible. No religion has so many names of God revealed to it. There's no religion. There are a dozen in Christianity, a few in Buddhism, in its own way, a few in Hinduism, but 99 names of God. That's unbelievable. And it was because of the terminal religion of the world, the Khat. And so God decided to open all these different doors to Him. Each door of the divine name, the door to Allah Ta'ala, both in meaning and in walking through the door. And so, absoluteness is ultimately, La ilaha illa illallah, I mean, there's no reality but Allah. Ultimate reality belongs to Him alone. There's no second to Him. Absoluteness denies all secondary reality, all relativity. To be two is to be relative, because you enter into relationality. And relationality and relativity are etymologically related, obviously. So it means to be actually one in the absolute sense, in the sense of no otherness being comparable to it. But the other aspect is infinite. And the Quran refers oftentimes, for example, to this reality aspect, exactly the reality, بِيَدِهِ مَلَكُوتُ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. In His hand is the spiritual root of all things. So nothing could exist in manifestation without having its roots in God. And so it's infinite. God's creation is infinite. There's no bound to it. We cannot determine it. We cannot bind it. I mean, the classical mathematical infinity, any series, any x to the n series from n from 1 to infinity, even the integer 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's no end to it. No matter how much you count to the end of the world, you can still go on. Logically, there's no end to it. It's a reflection, really, of a metaphysical infinitude, the divine infinitude. Now, there are many subtle aspects to this, including I'm not going to talk about it here, but the reflection of this absolute divinity in the male creation of God and the infinity in the female creation, the summing of the divine infinitude, the female nature, the divine absolute is the male nature. And the Quran alludes to that somewhere, and also a very profound observation in Hadith. And but this is the very subtle issues that I do not want to get into now, but have many applications in many domains. Anyway, to come back, only there's goodness with a capital G, as God is the source of all that we consider to be good. Not only is the infinite and absolute, is the source of all that is good. And again, we have a set of divine names like Karama, Adala, Hiss, all these things which deal with divine goodness in one form or another, which issue from the divine nature. And the function of metaphysics is also to study that. It's interesting in Islam, you have treatises on divine names by theologians. One of the most famous by Imam Fakhruddin Razi, which has been studied by my dear friend Hamza Yusuf for the study of Quran. I was just correcting a chapter and the last week thinking about you. A very famous Asma al-Husna. Ghazali has another very beautiful treatise. Many people have written treatises on it. Ibn Arabi has scattered it and they're written about it. It's his favorite subject. And the reason is that these are keys to the understanding of divine nature. And you can go from theological or even linguistic understanding, how the particular Arabic term relates to some other Arabic term, but the highest level is the metaphysical one, in which there are actually windows into the understanding of the divine nature. And the fact that God revealed himself like this to Islam is something quite remarkable. I'm not a chauvinist. I'm a defender of all the religion that God has sent. I've been criticized a lot for this. I believe all heavenly religions should be respected, as the Quran itself does. And they always use the word religion in plural. Or ad-din, for the whole of humanity. And there's so many verses. I've spoken about this before. I will not get into it now. But it's remarkable that from this point of view, very few authors have paid attention to this. How much of himself God has revealed through his names for us. And how rare that is. I'm not saying that there's no religion, perhaps a religion 10,000 years ago we do not know about. Did God reveal other things? We do not know. But in every religion, God reveals some aspect of himself, but so many aspects are revealed to us. And metaphysics tries to understand the meaning of this. What does it mean when we say God is Kareem? What does Kareem mean? And names which are completely inward. God is Jamil. God is beautiful. What is divine beauty? Where do you find answers to this? In Islamic tradition is the treatise of metaphysics, written usually by the Sufis. I've been asked 100 times why Islam did not develop aesthetics. It's of course absurd, having created one of the most beautiful civilizations in the world. But in the West, you buy books of philosophy on logic, ethics, and then aesthetics. There's a part of a chapter of a book on general philosophy. Why don't we have a single book on aesthetics in Arabic or Persian? I've been asked that 100 times. I say, you're looking at the wrong place. Books of aesthetics are to be found in the writings of the Sufis on beauty. The Masnavi of Jalaluddin Rumi is one of the most profound books of aesthetics ever written. But nobody has bothered to pull out the aesthetics in the modern sense and systematize and present it. The reason is that the name Al-Jamil and Jamal deals with the very essence of God. Beauty pulls us to the very center of our being. It melts us. There's no possibility of spiritual realization without beauty. That's why beauty is so powerful. And Islam is based more on beauty than on love even. Christianity is based more on love than on beauty. So many modern Christians don't care whether a church looks beautiful or ugly, and we are emulating them and are building ugly mosques. But look at our classical civilization, everything was beautiful. I always say to my students, when we used to go to Bath as a child, I was taken by my mother and later by my father, they would put a piece of towel around our belt, so the lower part of the body would not show you for a little child. Now those pieces of towels are in living rooms that people are all frames because they're such beautiful cloth. I don't belong to the 13th century. This is my own life experience. Civilization in which beauty was everywhere. But who explained this beauty? It was actually Islamic metaphysics, and especially the Sufis. And among the Sufis, people like Ohadeddin Kermani, was a great Sufi of beauty, and especially Jalaluddin Rumi, what we call the supreme troubadour of beauty. But there are many others, many, many others. And this is something which, for us, this present generation, inshallah, to bring out for the world today. Now, having said all of this, and my time is almost up, I'm going to stop in about 2-3 minutes, give you a chance to ask a couple of questions. The role of metaphysics is also to understand the relative in light of the absolute. So it provides the key for a science which is not only at the relative like modern science, but at the relative in light of the divine, of the absolute. That's what Islam requires for every form of knowledge. Every form of knowledge must be related to God. And our whole intellectual heritage was based on this, from fiqh to poetry, and everything in between. It was the role of metaphysics to also provide the principles of all knowledge. And here Aristotle was like, the root of all knowledge, all forms of knowledge, is to be found in metaphysics, of all sciences. And Islamic civilization put this to effect. Islamic medicine. Ibn Sina first discusses the philosophical basis of the human body with metaphysical ideas. Astronomy. I can show you books on astronomy. Mathematics. Khayyam, the great Omar Khayyam, writing his algebra. At the beginning, he wrote the introduction. He writes a metaphysical introduction to the roots of mathematics, the divine mind in a certain sense. And you could go down every field, not to talk of fiqh only or kalam, even the sciences in today's world, something which is forgotten. Principle of cosmology and physics, principle of anthropology, providing the understanding of symbolism in the arts, both music and poetry, as well as the plastic arts, and finally, producing the most important support for the understanding what is the basis of the ethics of the social order. Why should we be good? For many people, because my father said so is enough. For others, that's not enough. And every civilization must have an answer at that point. Otherwise, that young man or woman will go elsewhere. And this providing answers which were comprehensible to intelligent young people when it came to the question of ethics and social structures must not be forgotten as one of the roles of metaphysics. These are all so much forgotten in modern research that is going on. I will end, my time is up. I will end with just 2 sentences. Where does one find such a thing? Where do we find this knowledge? First of all, it's only the heart of religion that provides it. No philosopher, Oxford or Harvard, will provide it for you. I didn't say which religion, but religion as such. The inner heart, esoteric. So difficult to attain these days, but not impossible. La takhlu al-arad an hujjatillah. The hadith of the Prophet in Arabic. The earth shall never be empty of the proofs of God. Those who are whose very presence is a proof of God. And it's a question of Christ saying, seek and ye shall find. And I would end by saying that all of this is a kind of animesis, that is a recollection in the Platonic sense, remembering, of waking up. Once you wake up, the pure knowledge stands in front of us. Thank you. Now, we have a few moments, and I'll be glad to take... Azerbaijan Khan, when does the session end? 15 minutes. All right. That I have 12 minutes, anyway. Azerbaijan Khan, could you come here, please? Come on, you can't just sit down and do all the work. Come on. Why don't you sit here and field the questions? But I don't know the audience like you do.
Sure.
Who does it?
have mics going on, they're volunteers, and they'll be taking them around.
Oh, but who is fielding the questions?
I'll do that.
All right.
Bismillah. First of all, thank you so much for coming. We're all honored to have you here. I think, I don't know if everybody in here realizes the stature that you're held in the non-Muslim community, you know, in the West, as one of the living philosophers. I have several questions, but I'm going to limit them to two. I want to know, one, you mentioned about Oliver Rush, and I was wondering, is there any evidence that he got his occasionalism from the Mutakallim?
What?
His occasionalism.
Yes.
Did he get that from our tradition, or was that something that he...
One of the professors, Lebanese professors, argued that occasionalism of Rush comes from Asharism.
Right.
And there's something to that. But we have no hard documents
to prove.
But it's quite likely. I mean, out of the example which nobody wants to accept, David Hume, who negated causality. You could negate causality by bringing examples. If you put a knife on the cheese and cut it, does the knife cut the cheese or God has willed the knife to go into the cheese? You know, this kind of thing. He takes one example, and trillions of examples possible, a piece of cotton being burned by fire. And that's in Azari.
Right.
So, logic would say somehow he got hold of this text, even in the 18th century. So surely Malebranche, who lived 150 years before David Hume, is quite possible, because there's so-called occasionalism, which Majid Fakhri is used for his famous book in 1954, some occasionalism. And he had studied, he converted for a while to Catholicism and studied with these priests. I think he came back to Islam later, they taught him medieval philosophy. He knows medieval Western philosophy well, he knows Latin. And he alludes that this is a possibility. And I, as a humble scholar of Islamic philosophy, do not want to give an ex cathedra statement, definitely yes.
Right.
But I would be on the side of those who believe it very likely that Malebranche picked up this idea, which was just floating around in Catholic circles in the 16th, 17th century, because although Descartes had criticized his classic philosophy, it was still being taught in almost all Catholic seminaries. So I'm sure Azari and Asheri was still being taught somewhere where Malebranche studied.
Thank you. The second question I had about wujud is the word that our tradition uses in Arabic, and just finding the right word to translate, because some translators in the books of Quran use existence, but obviously there's problems with that word. And so how do you see that in Western language, the use of being?
I have an essay written on the subject on how to translate wujud into four different English words, depending on what situation the word wujud is used in the Arabic. It can mean being with the capital B. You don't have capitalization in Arabic. It can mean being in the small b, including mawjudat, being beings. It can be existing with the capital E in the sense that I showed you what this means, according to the Quran, that the satiating aspect of being pure being, and can be existing in the small e. Like the wujud of that pencil on that lady's in front of the lady. I'm sorry, I'm standing up. My legs are stiff, so I'm standing up for a moment.
Assalamu alaikum.
Could you speak both slowly and loudly? Because the sound that may go well from this side, but it doesn't come back very well.
Okay. And my question has to do with the relationship between metaphysics and epistemology. Like in terms of how the Western, they always try to expound on many, many metaphysics, but the problem has always been to epistemically show these metaphysical contents. So how does this relate to Islamic metaphysics and then showing these epistemically? So in terms of Heidegger, in terms of why he chose to put being in terms of the human, is in terms of epistemology, in terms of connecting the human being as to what he knows. So how do you do that through Islamic metaphysics?
I'm going to be dealing with this issue in an hour, but I will very quickly answer you. Metaphysics is the authentic sense, whether Islamic or Hindu or anything else, always deals with epistemology. The roots of epistemology are found in metaphysics. That is the question of the subject who knows and how he knows are related to metaphysics. What happened in the West, we went from metaphysics to epistemology, to logic, to illogicality. If you can put it existentialism, which tried to go against logic, and now deconstructionism, which is postmodernism. That is the four stages that Western philosophy really followed from the 16th century onward. But for us, metaphysics contains the principles of epistemology. And we can know metaphysics because there is something in us called the intellect, which can know things in principle and not its applications. And I'm going to be talking about that. Because it's a very, very important issue. There's so much confusion, including by Heidegger, because intellect, although he uses it all the time, and you know Greek so well, is not the same thing as how what modern philosophy says it is. You know, same thing as reason. The levels of the intellect, and Heidegger simply refuses to look at those, what we consider Islamic metaphysics, to be higher levels of intellect, which enable the human being these levels, to know in a principial way and in a sense to know what is already written upon the tablet of the heart with intellect results. And therefore the famous hadith, know thyself, he who knows himself knows his Lord. Why is it if I know myself? Man arafa nafsahu rabbah. Why is it if I know myself I know God? Because already the reality of God is inscribed in myself. And once I know myself, by virtue of that knowledge, I already have knowledge of God. I shall deal with this more extensively, inshallah, very soon.
Last question.
Yes, sir.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
I'm curious if metaphysics addresses a paradox that I have always wrestled with my whole life. So the idea of looking at the physical world and seeing what appears to be miracles happening. What appears to be miracles happening in the physical world. So like the past century or two, you see television or the airplane or cars, so on and so forth. That seems like we've moved away from metaphysics and we see all these apparent miracles happening in the physical world. But paradoxically, what I'm understanding from you and from metaphysics in general is miracles that happen on an interdimensional. Does metaphysics talk about that paradox?
First of all, can you use the word paradox? What is the paradox? Paradox is a logical term. When two terms cannot be logically included and work with each other, they become a paradox. First of all, I don't see any miracles occurring. You said miracles are the structure of the earth and we're all going to someday very soon. I don't see any miracles around us. Miracle in reverse. Schwann once said so beautifully, he said, the modern world and the Greek world, the miracles in reverse. But everybody talks about the Greek miracle. Nobody talks about the Indian miracle, the Persian miracle. Everybody talks about the Greek miracle. So it's a miracle in reverse. I would not use the word miracle. The modern world had invented many tools and gadgets in the field of pure science. Quantum mechanics has been able to gain an insight into the potential world which underlies, in fact, the already actualized world of subatomic particles. This is a heavy statement I make, but it's a physical statement I have to make it. But other than that, I don't see any paradox. Yeah, and what has happened was that the spiritual world has been eclipsed,
yes,
by the modern world. And eclipse and paradox are two very different things. Yes, we're in a world in which, in fact, metaphysics is eclipsed. Modern Western civilization and now its extension to other continents are the first time in human history where you could live in a city, look around all over the city, and without a single sage who will teach you wisdom.
I didn't condition it with a parent miracle. Is that the best?
Pardon language.
I didn't condition it with a parent's miracle. I can't think of a better language to use. I just noticed, I agree with what you're saying, spiritual knowledge gets eclipsed, and the next thing we know, human civilization comes up with airplanes, internet, so on and so forth. To me, that's a paradox, and again, maybe I'm using that incorrectly as well.
No, it's not a paradox at all. Every time a heaven is lost, a new earth is discovered by compensation by the devil, in my sense. This is not my city. Again, the same as Friedrich Schwann, that remarkable man who has read so little these days, but the most remarkable thing has been made. That there's a compensation for the loss of every heaven, but the discovery of a new earth. We are in the middle of one of those right now. I'm trying my hardest not to learn the computer, to die without learning the computer. All my degrees from Harvard and MIT, I don't want to learn the computer, but it's pushing upon me. I think I'll win out finally. But my friends actually do the job for me. So I'm not really fair to them. I asked them to help. But anyway, joking aside, the whole computer cyberspace has provided modern man with a new pseudo world that is via Platonic cave. It's now the shadow of the shadow of the wall of the dead. The shadow of what Plato called the world of shadows. And most people live in that. You go to a party, four people are sitting down, nobody's talking to each other, they're all going like this. But people live in that world to a large extent. But that has certain compensations. Otherwise, it would not occur. Even intellectual compensations. You can look up the book of the Song of Solomon in 1 second and read it on the train. You couldn't do that before. So it's something that attracts. But altogether, it takes you to a lower level of reality. And the fall of man, really, is characterized by a series of such falls. With every fall has come the discovery of a new earth, what appeared to be an earth of infinite possibilities. Look how what happened in Europe. Europeans turned against their own tradition, against Christianity. But they captured the Americas, all the wealth, they killed millions of Indians, but that didn't worry about that. Or Australia, other places, Africa, and for them we discovered a whole new world. So forgetting and abusing the medieval world, which was forgotten so rapidly, was nothing to them. Nothing to them. I mean, buildings built 50 years after the Shaft Cathedral are ugly already. I mean, they're not divine buildings, they're anthropomorphic. They're completely worldly, and they're supposed to be churches. And we are put off by them. Many Christians are put off by the Vatican itself. It's a palace, it's a 16th century palace. It's not Christian art. Christian art at San Maggiore Church in Rome, if you want to go to Italy. North France, in France. Those are Christian art. It was all forgotten when the new earth was discovered, you might say. And we are right in the middle of this process right now. We're all duped, in a sense, into the ease with which we are able to navigate the cyber world. But what has happened to human relations? I just had dinner with my grandson 2 nights ago. Why couldn't I speak one word to him? He greeted me, assalamu alaikum, and I was under it. You pay a price. So, I don't think the question of paradox is called the question of fall. But since we are human beings, it's always possible to undo the effect of every fall. We can always return. And the Quranic saying, La ta'budu bi rahmatillah, never lose hope in the mercy of God. One of its meanings is that there's always the possibility of return. You don't have to participate in the fall because we know we're dealing with the age. I think I've spoken now. Thank you.